It began with a restlessness, but I did not know what it meant, what they wanted from me. There was an ominous atmosphere all around me. I had the strange feeling that the air was filled with ghostly entities. Then it was as if my house began to be haunted. Around 5 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday, the front doorbell began ringing frantically, but there was no one in sight. I was sitting near the doorbell, and not only heard it, but saw it moving. We all simply stared at one another. The atmosphere was thick, believe me. Then I knew that something had to happen. The whole house was filled as if there were a crowd present, crammed full of spirits. They were packed deep right up to the door, and the air was so thick it was scarcely possible to breathe. As for myself, I was all a quiver with the question. For God's sake, what in the world is this? And then they cried out in a chorus, "We have come back from Jerusalem, where we did not find what we were looking for." Carl Jung, talking about the 7 sermons of the dead from the Red Book. I am recording right now, as of now. Go ahead, sir.
Top of the morning to you, laddies. Welcome back to the Uber Boyo channel. Today I am joined by Jacksepticeye. How are you doing, sir?
Septicai is now my middle name, sir. My last name's O'Donoghue Smith. So how are you, sir? I heard your name is North McNorfeeton.
I can't switch accents that easily on the fly.
What would a North be like? It's like, no, my name's just North. Terry North.
You better shut the fuck up now before I fucking stab you in the gut. No, it's still not quite right. I can't do it. I'm a North by spirits, but not a North in flesh.
Terry North, mate. Terry North from Liverpool, mate. From Manchester. It wouldn't be Liverpool, yeah. Speaking of Liverpool, I haven't got a picture of Carl Jung up here, and he was famous for saying that Liverpool is the source of all life on the world or something like that. Is that what the quote was?
Yeah, apparently he had a vision of Liverpool in a dream despite never going there, and then afterwards he wrote in a book somewhere, Liverpool is the pool of life. So now Liverpool, having nothing for it except Paul McCartney, has a statue of Carl Jung up with Liverpool is the pool of life. No one knows what the hell it means. He probably had no idea what the hell it meant, but there you go. So he was a Northman at heart as well.
I encourage everyone who is watching this, who enjoys Carl Jung's company, to by all means go on YouTube and find a video of Carl Jung, because you'll notice a very interesting nuance is that he's a Swiss, German-speaking Swiss, or was he? It might have been Austrian. I can't really remember anyway. But nonetheless, he speaks German, but he also speaks English, and he speaks English with this slight Liverpool Scouser accent. It's almost like he's like this really, really weird member of the Beatles or something like that, talking about like archetypes and all this stuff. And you're like, whoa. And another very interesting trivia, and we're going to get into this, all this cool stuff as well, is that Carl Jung worked mainly in the city Basel, where Albert Hofmann invented LSD. And he was working around about the same time that was going on. So we have some very interesting things, and we're going to get into what we could call Carl Jung's mystic side, because people don't cover this a lot. Carl Jung hid it a little bit. The book we're about to get into now wasn't even released until only a couple of years ago, because he was so afraid people would think he's crazy and discredit all his theories. So we're about to get into the funky side, the Beatles side of Jung, I guess is what we could say. But Jimmy is the one who studied this in rich depth. He's put up his barriers around his house to protect him from the Norths, the Hadrian's Wall around his house to protect him from the Norths, and he's gone and he's created a great intellectual endeavor, sir. So tell us, what are your thoughts with all this?
Yes. So I've been reading the Red Book quite a lot recently, quite in depth. I got the Reader's Edition version because the other one is just far too expensive and just absolutely freaking ridiculous. And apart from being full of like MK Ultra shit, it reads like a madman, essentially. It's as if someone has gone insane, but has remained sane enough to the point where he can write down all the things in which he is seeing. So apart from talking about Norse and MK Ultra, etc., what we're going to do in this video essentially is go over what the hell the Red Book was, why the hell it was so significant, and how you, if you were insane enough, I actually don't recommend doing this, by the way, how you can go ahead and make your own. So Stefan, on your voyages around the internet, what do you think about this particular book, this particular line of Jung's thought?
Well, I will say, and exactly what you're saying, you say you don't recommend people do what Jung did. And I came in contact with Jung, and this was actually one of the main reasons I got into Jung, is because I found out this story about the Red Book. And as I was saying, I was very interested in the idea of getting something useful out of this. It's almost like I find it interesting that people have this attitude towards knowledge, that it's this thing in it itself. But I guess Nietzsche and even Jung himself taught me to a large extent that you have to treat knowledge as a tool. And what I discovered in Jung was that he was saying, okay, I'm talking about all these mad theories about archetypes, but there's fundamentally, there's something pragmatic about this. There's something you can do that will help you. And I was thinking, I want to be able to tell great stories. I want to make great art. I want to achieve something creative. And so I'm gonna talk about this a lot now as we're going through this, about why you study these people. What's the end goal? It kind of comes down to building yourself into something, making yourself turn into a creative being, building a personality and all this. And Carl Jung's Red Book is his, I guess you could say, personal project where he worked on himself. And what he was doing is he was, as they all say, making the unconscious conscious. He was digging into the dream world and pulling out images and I guess you could say tools and interesting totems and all that, and bringing them back and studying them. And that gave him this amazing book that we have to learn from. So by all means, the thing that got me into this was like, oh shit, could I go into my own unconscious, my own imagination, and could I do something like Jung and bring it forward and have, I don't know, you might have listened to my last song, some very, very interesting characters showing up that you're able to vibe with and be like, whoa, there's some dark stuff and crazy stuff and cool stuff and profound stuff down here. I like, from reading this and from reading Manon of Symbols, I ended up doing a lot of dream reading, and I did it the way he said to do it. Like, most people are like, dream dictionaries, yeah, and all this stuff.
Dictionaries are full of nothing but complete shite. It's unbelievable how bad they are.
And then, like, there's a reason why that is because Jung was saying it's so contextual to the individual. And he's showing you, not telling you in this. This is like him doing what you're supposed to do. And then when you understand, it's like, whoa, that's what he's doing. You can go do it yourself, and it becomes like this amazing intellectual tool that you have, because you can, it's like the ultimate cure to writer's block, if you want to put it in really coarse terms. It's like you can just crack open this portal and let forward. Like, the thing is that the reason why you probably won't want to do that is because it's so potent that you'll get so much stuff that will send you insane, as Jung talks about, as he was getting haunted and all that stuff.
Well, that's just the thing. Like, dream reading is all well and good, and that's basically what Jung was doing in this. And, you know, if you think about what a dream is, it's things which appear to you in the unconscious. And that's fine, because we spend a third of our lives unconscious. But I did stress not recommending doing this, because a lot of young people, whatever, very high in openness people, are going to say, I really, really, really want to go and make my own Red Book. It's going to be really great fun, and I'm going to become a superhero and all this stuff. It's very, very dangerous to do this stuff on multiple different dimensions, as we'll get into in this. So without any further ado, I think we should crack into this.
Tear on, sir.
So we're going to break this down into multiple different parts. We're trying to make this as ominous as possible. Let's talk about the haunting of Carl Jung, first of all. Got a little quotes here, which is interesting, and this is something people who cursorily study Jung don't really understand. It's quote is basically, my whole career was an expansion on a vision.
Yeah,
so
wow, that's
a psychotherapist at the same time as Jung. You know, he was with Freud around this time. I think he was with Freud for a few years by the time he started doing all this stuff. They were approaching it very intellectually, of course. They were trying to deduce what different psychoses were based on their own rationality, whereas Jung did it the other way around, where he basically went mad and then expanded all of his rationality from the madness, which is completely terrifying. So in 1913 and 1914, so this is around the dawn of World War I, Jung had 12 different distinct visions of the apocalypse. And of course, if you get a vision of the apocalypse, it's probably gonna you know, knock you for six, basically. You're not going to understand what the hell's going on. And you can interpret it in many ways. Like there's a card in tarot, for example, called the death card. And when you pull this card out, people get scared of it. But what it really is meant to mean, essentially, is that you are going to go through a rebirth very soon. So you read it in a metaphorical way. But Jung didn't believe that this was a metaphor for a rebirth. He believed this was the apocalypse. And this was because it was around the outbreak of World War One. Of course, if you studied World War One, you knew it was basically, at least on the Western Front, trenches of death. So one of the most famous visions Jung had at this time was he was riding on a train and he looked out the window and he saw, he wasn't asleep, he actually saw with his own eyes, crystal clear, these rivers of blood flowing across the mountains and the fields outside where he was, destroying everything. And it was like, well, this isn't normal. Am I going mad? And the answer is maybe. He for a period of many, many years, he was afraid that he was literally going insane. Now, you can understand this, but now knowing what we know about Jungian individuation, when you are about the age 35 to 40, somewhere around there, what happens is you generally start to experience the world in a different way. Different dimensions of life open up to you. And this is called basically a descent into the underworld. You go into your shadow, for example. This is what Dante did at the beginning of the Divine Comedy. He went down into the underworld to confront what was going on in his life. So we can contextualize madness around this time and visions around this time as, well, that's healthy and that's normal now. A midlife crisis, basically, if you don't manage it properly. Whereas Jung at the time thought that he was going completely and utterly mad. So around this time, Jung, as a bodybuilder at the time, he actually has another book called The Blue Book, by the way, which is his experiments with TRT therapy. But we'll cover that in another video, I guess. What he was doing was he decided to voluntarily start encountering the unconscious, which we're going to tell you basically how he did that and what that was later. And of course, what you heard in the intro, the very beautiful intro that Stefan did at the very beginning, was how the Seven Sermons of the Dead, which is an early part of this Red Book, was created, where because he was experimenting with visions and dreams and talking to these characters, very, very strange things started happening in his environment around him. He actually started to get haunted. There's a very interesting book that you can read on this. It's by an academic from, it was a university very close to me. I can't quite remember which one, which always made me feel very happy. But it's called Jung on the Paranormal. And reading that will make it so you can't go to sleep. Because when you grow up, your parents always tell you there's no such thing as ghosts. Jung goes, yeah, there are. And there are like two types of ghosts. If you want to be really funky about this, there are like shamanic ghosts, which is like projections from the unconscious, like visions and mirages and stuff like that. Or there's literal spirits.
Oh, Jesus, stop. Like, this part's always kind of fucked with me a bit, because I sort of do have this materialistic, rationalistic worldview, and just when you start hearing like someone like Jung, like he's a man you trust, if you know what I mean. Like he's someone you're really into, and I kind of, just when he starts talking about ghosts, and he's sort of this, you know, this is like an authority, I guess you could say, and he's being like, yeah, dude, I kind of think I got haunted. You're like, oh shit, man, what's going on here?
Well, the thing was, these spirits were also verified by other people. Of course, the Seven Sermons of the Dead is a classic one, because everyone else saw the doorbell ringing. But there was another occasion where he went to a cottage, and everyone knew that the cottage was haunted, but they didn't tell him. And he independently found out very unpleasantly that the cottage was haunted. It was something like the wall started oozing this green pus. And he woke up one night in the middle of the night, and there was this woman with half of her face sitting in the bed next to him, staring at him.
Fuck off, dude. Why am I doing this? Like, I'm just going to hang up now. Like, please, no, thank you.
he got up, he put a candle on and turned it towards it, and then it sort of disappeared. And he had to spend like the rest of the night outside, like on a camp bed or something. He's like, I cannot fucking do this anymore. And early stages of his career after this, he started rationalizing it, going, well, I was really tired and I was really stressed. And I'm kind of a shamanic man in general. It must have just been projections from my unconscious. But then he did later, at the end of his career, when things started to change quite a lot, say, yeah, I can't explain it. I literally cannot explain what I saw. Like, he used to encounter, he went to seances and stuff like that, and people levitating, loads of paranormal stuff. It's absolutely terrifying. Go on.
This is just a very interesting thing to put out into the world, because he is coming from a man who has a scientific perspective, and he tries his best to be scientifically rigorous. People often criticize him for not like living up to that and all that. But
it's so evidential that there's something weird about what's going on. So maybe he was crazy, but he did seem a bit together at the same time. Like he pulled off a great career and all that. And so when we think in the past, it's easy to kind of rationalize and be like, oh, what our ancestors saw when they were seeing all this paranormal shit was like, you know, archetypes and all that stuff. And it's all this like stuff that makes perfect sense and fits in our modern worldview and all that. But here you have a very big part of our intellectual history sort of saying, I witnessed some stuff that violated everything you're supposed to know about reality. And it's all down in this book. And it only came out a couple of years ago. And when you read it, like, you're going to find it hard to go to sleep, man. And what does that mean? You know, what were the ancients telling stories, or were the ancients telling stories?
Yeah.
Like, it's hard to know. It's hard to know.
Yeah, well, how many high profile schizophrenics do you know that are in positions of responsibility? It's like they don't really exist because they hear the voices and it means that they can't, you know, rise to that level of competency within society. Whereas people like to dismiss Jung for these and go, he was clearly schizophrenic and mad. It's like, you're not schizophrenic and mad if you're a therapist and you have a wife and you have kids and all this stuff. It's like, it doesn't work. So it's very, very peculiar. But writing the Red Book, writing down his encounters by exploring what he was doing in a literary and in a drawing, painting-y aesthetic manner, that stopped the spirits haunting him. That was something he noted, because once he wrote the Seven Sermons to the Dead, which is at the start of the Red Book, the spirits basically disappeared.
Wow, that's very interesting. That actually it does a lot of credit to what I'm going to say later. So you just made me, I'm just like, yeah, Stefan, you're on the fucking money again.
Yeah, yeah. So when he took it to the next level, basically.
Could I read your little speech bubble?
Go on.
Carling for life. I love this. Hello, Carl. I am your inner north. Hello, Carl. I'm your inner north. I bring you Greg's coupons from beyond the ether.
Yeah, so obviously when you hit with visions, that's one type of spiritual experience. But Jung decided that he actually had to voluntarily go and bring on the visions himself. It was like, I'm not letting you take me away. I'm going to be the one to go and confront you. He did this through a technique called active imagination. And what happened was characters came up from his unconscious that started to talk to him. And he would actually verbally converse with these particular characters, some of which were very helpful to him, like this Northman. It's always good to have a nice Greg's coupon so you can have a nice sandwich on your Sunday morning commute. But then sometimes characters weren't so friendly either. There was actually an encounter he had with a literal Satan. I think he encountered Satan two or three times, if I recall. And that's not friendly at all. And things like that shook him. And he would wake up after tentatively. He would come out of a vision, and then he would, you know, write down what he did, then get on with his normal life. And when he would go back into the visions again, he would pick up where they left off, which mm-hmm. is again exceptionally strange. It's as if his soul, quote unquote, existed in two parallel universes at the same time. I am speaking metaphorically here.
Allow me to interject just briefly.
You may. I will allow it.
Well, yeah. I was going to ask, like, do you think if you cracked into your unconscious, you think you just find this like giant vista, this giant like Narnia of Norths? Do you think that's what it'd be there?
This is a photo from my unconscious. Yeah.
It's just Jung and he's surrounded by Norths and he's in chains and he's like a damsel in distress. He's like, James, save me. I have a more serious thing to say though, is that just to give really a sort of grounded understanding of what Jung is doing here theoretically, and this is what kind of resonated with me so much, is that Jung goes and he says we all have an unconscious, and Freud's like, yeah, we all have an unconscious, and you're like, yeah, cool, whatever, what does that mean? They're speaking about something that is very ancient and known as and it's sort of proved through modern like neurology or neuroscience or whatever you want to call it. We don't keep everything in our awareness. Like when you're walking around during the day, all the memories that make up your life are stored in this hidden fridge, in this hard drive at the back of your mind. And there's something about going into that hard drive, which I guess you could say is you access through imagining things. Like when you sit down and when you memorize something, you notice that it comes to you almost like a vision. And sometimes it comes to you not at your choice. Like you're there with someone like a girl or something like that, and she calls you silly, and that reminds you of your sister calling you silly, and you get angry at her for no reason. It's this weird unconscious connection. And so you could almost call it like a place. And this is the kind of the way I began to understand what Jung was saying, is like the unconscious is a place. It's like Narnia. It's like Harry Potter land. It's like in Irish Irish mythology, it's the other world, you know, it's Tírna n Óg. It's all throughout myths, they have the other world, and it seems to be this vista of the imagination. And Jung is just speaking, he's talking about a very updated version of a very, very old behavior where you go into that. And the artist does it all the time. They're maybe less conscious of what they're doing. Jung is very articulately aware of that, but you're always digging into this place through your imagination, and Jung just sort of went all in. And saw what happened. No, maybe the better way to say it is that most people go to Narnia by climbing in the wardrobe. But what Jung did is opened up the wardrobe and said, out you come. And that's a very, very, very interesting behavior. And that's, I think, why you're warning people, don't just do what Jung did, because Jung was inviting them into his world where it might be smarter to try control it. Like, this is what I'm talking about, doing something like art, because if you're just sort of like, on you come ghosts, well, then you might meet ghosts. And that sounds cool until you meet them. Then it becomes weird.
Well, because that begs the question, what's the bleed over between those two different worlds? We don't know. Clearly you can move between the two worlds, obviously, and that's what Plato believed, that obviously we existed as a soul sort of in another realm, and then we came down and inhabited the body, and then all we were doing by learning was remembering what we previously knew, which is very interesting to put it into context of this, where the characters told him things which he didn't know about. They actually told him, but it was like eternal wisdom. So yeah, it's interesting to think where that crossover between the worlds could be. And the crossover between that worlds would be ghosts and spirits. Because lots of people with paranormal encounters say, like, it's as if I can access another world. There are characters around me which shouldn't really be here, but they're here for unfinished business. You know, what the hell does that mean, unfinished business? It's something to do with you consciously engaging with them, which is terrifying.
Go. So I want to make a specific point on why Jung was doing this, or maybe I should say it more like why you should do what he is saying and what you should take out of this. A lot of people read about Jung's Red Book and they think that they need to sit down, as we said, and open up Narnia and let madness into their lives. And we definitely don't want to be the ones responsible for putting that idea in your head. But at the same time, I don't even think it's the most useful. The way I did this, the what I took out of it, was my understanding of what Jung was recommending to you. He talks about this fancy thing called individuation, and he's always being like, take the unconscious and make it conscious. And a good test on how much you understand something is your ability to not use the jargon, not use the words like individuation, unconscious. They're all sort of nonsense, empty words to a large extent that are used for people to communicate in some sense. But what I think he's saying when he says individuation is you want to build a personality. And that's a really esoteric thing still, but we're at least starting to get a grip on what he's trying to say here. He's saying you want to develop character, you want to develop style. Like, you can listen to a musician. This is a very interesting thing for a musician or an artist. You can listen to a musician like Miles Davis. He doesn't come across as like super technically talented, but he is far more interesting than someone who is actually vastly better at a jazz than he is. And you get this all around the musical sphere. You have all sorts of singers. Jim Morrison, like, a pretty awful singer by all standards, but he's a very like intoxicating person to listen to, and it's almost like there's something shining out of these people that is different than their skill. There's something more to them that's, it's very hard to put your finger on, and I would call that personality. And it's a hard thing to understand how to build that, because you can go in, you'd be like, I'll train my singing voice or something like that, I'll take lessons, but that's not going to make you sound like someone who has a story, who has a vibe. But people used to always say about the singer for Alice in Chains or Kurt Cobain as well, is that whenever you'd listen to him sing, you knew he meant it. And the same from Miles Davis was saying, no matter how good you are, when you're listening to someone play, you're listening to who the person is and what they've been through. And that's a very interesting notion, because oftentimes you'll find yourself practicing trying to hide your lack of personality behind skill, and you sometimes get that in these endeavors. And so what I came to understand Jung is describing is like he's pushing you towards developing personality. Now, this doesn't have to be like open up your Narnia and meet ghosts and all that, although that will make you more interesting. It's not exactly the only way you can do this. There's vast the ways you can do this. Jung was often saying you could individuate by simply facing your fears and taking action in your life, and that is by baseline what I recommend for everybody. That's the one that would least likely send you insane, so I'd recommend you do that. I guarantee you're not doing that enough as it is. But if you want to add style to your character, say as a creative, it's a little bit hard. it's a little bit harder to with the whole face the fear thing. Sometimes if you have like if you're an intellectual or something like that, it's just a little bit. You have a little bit. You need to master the mind somewhat. So giving style to your character is. I'm building this personality is what Jung is saying when he is going into the unconscious and pulling out stories out of it. You know what I mean? This is his whole idea of individuation. You're pulling out, I guess you could say, hidden perspectives, things you haven't thought about, things you're afraid of thinking about, weird thoughts, and also the deep thoughts of your history, which weirdly are stored in you. Like, you might not really be conscious of the Western canon, but if you dig into this stuff, a surprising amount of it finds its way into your unconscious somehow. We don't know how that stuff happens. And if you can start doing what Jung says is integrate those. So you use the best way to visualize it is like you literally go into Narnia and you start pulling up all this stuff. The best way I think to do it is, this is the way I did it, is read your dreams, and you start like looking at all these characters, kind of pull them out of the dreams and play with them as Jung was doing, but I did it more in a page. And you just be like, well, what does this mean? What does this character represent and all this stuff? And they all start to coagulate and bring these huge vistas of knowledge, and all these symbols start to connect deep into the past, your own past, but also the past of your culture and all that. And it begins to deepen who you are to a large extent. And if you can combine that with facing fears in real life and doing stuff that you're afraid of in real life and pushing your limits and all that way, you will most definitely start to reach the holy grail of creativity. Because I guess what you're doing here is you're confronting your quote-unquote shadow. You're going into what you don't know, and when you do it, and when you go into that unknown and that scary side of you and these things that you ignored, you thought were mundane and pointless and all that and stupid, you start to like the Narnia starts to flow out something that is treasured, which is energy. It's, I guess you could call it libido or life energy or creative energy, the spark. And once you start getting that, it's considered one of the greatest assets you can have in the world. I'm just going to read a quote by Nietzsche. He says, "The overman, he who has organized the chaos of his passions, given style to his character, and become creative. Aware of life's terrors, he affirms life without resentment." And all these men, they're all saying, you got to figure out how you can become creative. You got to build a personality. You got to individuate. You got to be special. And in a large extent, Jung is showing you how he did that, how he got his own perspectives. Because a lot of what he drew out of this was quite novel, quite a lot of his new things. So this is why I think this is such an important book to understand the practical sense. Any thoughts, Jimmy?
Yeah. So if you want to take this stuff seriously, then you've got to run with the presupposition that dreams are not random and visions from the unconscious are not random. If you accept that at least, which if you accept Jungian psychology, then you do, then whatever happens during your unconscious happens for a reason, and it's used to compensate for you. And it's a big part of who you are. So you're a character going through your own story. And part of your story might be in this nether realm, but it's still, you're on planet Earth and you're living your life. You're your own character, basically. And you have your own fears and you have your own drawbacks. And basically what this stuff is advanced level shadow work for very nerdy, open people. But the principle still applies in general for the average layman, I guess, is you have your own fears and you're going through life. What's your biggest problem that you're currently coming across? And you'll find that those themes are mirrored in your dreams. Or if they're not, then that might reveal to you what your truly biggest problem is. And through engaging in a dialogue with that, in terms of a dream vision type dynamic, that's the same thing as actually going out and confronting your fear. It's as if the fear is confronted on two levels at the same time. Yes. Again, if you're a nerdy person, you can, and you need that more intellectual, rational, heady, experiential stuff, then you can go do it the dream reading way. But honestly, and Jung would support this, the best thing you can do is to go out and face your problem head on and to actually solve it. Because once you solve it, that's exactly what the alchemists, for example, were trying to do in terms of creating the Philosopher's Stone, which of course is what Jung was very, very interested in. It's let's resolve the great opposites and the tensions in our lives. We can do it in symbolic form, or we can do it acted out in the world. And Jung had a massive, massive problem in his life. And it all stemmed from the book, or the play technically, Faust, by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, which is the greatest name of all time. That's what we're going to talk about here. And here's a quote for you again. "God is not dead. He is as alive as ever." And of course, that's a reference to Friedrich Nietzsche's great "God is fucking dead." So Faust is a play. It was written over the course of about 60 years, I think. I'll rewind the clock. It's one of those spontaneous myths where no one really knows where it came from. That's the best way of putting it. It was first properly articulated in English by Christopher Marlowe in the 1500s. And it does seem to sort of revolve around a real man, just like the story of Christ did. But Goethe was the one who properly articulated this in the 1700s and 1800s. And basically, the story of Faust is a man who is, and he writes it in beautiful soliloquies. It's a man who's trying to reach God through his intellect, essentially, but he's left unsatisfied by it. And he makes a deal with the devil who comes down. It's like a very Jobian play that goes on here between God and Satan warring for Faust's soul. And God says to Mephistopheles, who is Satan, basically, and you can see him there in his standard devil attire, is, if you can get Faust to long for a moment to continue for more than just a moment, so to actually entice his soul into staying alive and to enjoying life, then you can take him. You know, there was a big Faustian split essentially between the intellect and between the more experiential side of life. And Jung said that Faust Part Two in particular was something which really, really resonated with him. And there's a scene in Faust Part Two, which I've got an actual photo here from the National Youth Theatre here. It's in Faust Part Two, Act Five. So Faust and Mephistopheles are just swagging about doing their thing, and Faust wants a house to be built wants a mansion to be built on this hill. But there's already a little cottage there, and living inside is this man called Philemon, who's actually a very old biblical character. He's living there, and he says, "Mephistopheles, with your almighty power, can you please just move the cottage out of the way?" Mephistopheles goes, "Sure, man, sure." So he burns the whole cottage down. And Faust is like, no, I didn't want you to burn it down. So Philemon is like, "Faust, why you do this to your boy Philemon?" And that really upset Jung, really, really upset Jung. It's actually like ruptured his soul. And it was this Faustian bargain in the European soul, which was voluntary in a way, where they didn't have to kill these more religious icons. They didn't have to get rid of them. But a lot of it was voluntary. They chose the intellect over God. That's that Faustian bargain. So around this time, 1913 to 16, did you want something to say? Sorry.
I actually wanted to put a note, because I'm listening to Dan Carlin talk about World War One, and we've obviously talked about Ion and all that. Yeah, that picture. Let's stick on that picture. I'm listening to Carl Jung and all that talk about. So one note, two things. One note is from earlier you were saying people go out and act in the world and then your dreams reflect that. And there's actually ample evidence to show, you'll hear this anecdotally, like Conor McGregor is a very famous example. He says he really started to get good at fighting when he would fight, and then he would go into the locker room after he would fight and document what he just witnessed. He would take out of his mind and study it. And he even did that during his fights as he was coming up. And when he lost that, he said he actually felt he lost quite a lot. Your brain needs some help. Your brain needs to help processing things. So Jung is going through this conflict inside him, which is, as he said, is a collective conflict, this war with the Faustian spirit, if you will. And he's expressing it. He's trying to deal with this through his Red Book, and he's going like really deep into Narnia. Conor McGregor goes into Narnia, and he's like, "How do I beat the shit out of people?" And then he does a little bit of writing to help him and all that. And he notes, like, he goes out and he fights, and then he writes down his little sparring session and all that. But so there's that, and then so Jung is doing this. So yes, if you want to do this, you can do it something like Conor. If you go deeper, you want to go more elaborate and all this, you'll start getting something more like Jung. It's all good. Do something like that. I recommend it. It's journaling in its basic sense. But Jung started to do this. He was getting this Faustian problem that's related to the collective problem of the Europeans. And I'm listening to Dan Carlin talk about World War One and just how, like, the great thing about this podcast is how he's able to make you understand how they felt, like what it was like for them, because they were all, after 100 years of no war at all. And so it was very, very interesting, because what would happen in the last 100 years is they had reached the peak of the Faustian spirit. Europe was the largest empire and owned the entire world. And the industrial age was just over. So they had all, the populations had exploded. They'd all raised up high into the heavens. They lived in this sort of, I don't know, did you see the Olympic
opening ceremony for the British, where it was like a load of happy load of British folk in the farmyards and all this, and then there's this suddenly dark moment, and then suddenly all these like Mordor like and bear in mind Tolkien wrote Lord of the Rings during this period as well. This is a very important period of history. We don't hear about it enough, but Mordor start, or Isengard, I think Isengard is the better one, Isengard starts to rise up, and it is, as James is saying, it was the Europeans' choice. We are going to save ourselves from this terrible tragedy, which is life. We are going to win. We're not going to wait for, as Samuel Beckett would later say, we're not going to wait for God to save us. We're not going to wait for Christ to come at the end of time and zip down out of the sky and save us. What we're going to do is we're going to save ourselves. And the Faustian energy brought us forward and up and up and up. And then World War One was this very, very hard wake-up call. It was definitely a Faustian bargain, because suddenly we had all this food, we had these booming populations, and then essentially brothers went to war. Like the Anglos went against the Germans and the French. They're all related, you know, they're all this, like we've done other videos, they're all the same haplogroup, like they're all pretty much the same people. And they went to war, and in one battle they lost more people than they did in the entire century beforehand. It was amazing, because it was just so inhuman. They realized for the first time that men don't matter. It's machines rule this world now. They would send a charge at the Somme. 60,000 people, I think, died in the first day. And they're just sending flesh. And your personality is meaningless here. And you just go run at that gun and die. And they're just getting mowed down, cut apart. Like, and the entire experience was like the front in the Western Front didn't even move that much from France. It was just there the whole time, and everybody just died for inches that they would later lose a couple of months later and all this. And it completely dehumanized everybody. It completely shook the entire world to pieces. I think the French lost more in the first 3 years than the American nation had ever lost up to that point. It was unbelievable. Yes. the extent. People could not believe.
I think it was Verdun, where the smell of rotting corpses spread for miles and miles and miles. Yeah. You could smell, without having any idea that this battle was actually going on, you could smell the corpses.
Yeah, like, it's
that,
unbelievable.
That is horrific.
Oh, it's unbelievable. And shell shock started to happen then and all that stuff. And it was just so inhuman. And it's not even like inhuman makes it sound cruel. It's not even about that. It was just so scary, because before, war was all about the great heroic Achilles killing you. But this war was all about making you realize that you don't matter at all. It's not about you understanding that like there's this evil force out to get you. It's just like you literally live in a machine, and the machine will kill you and it won't care. It's not about hate, it's just it doesn't care, you don't matter. And so when your general says for nation you must charge at that gun, that's what happened. And then you died, and if you were 17, that was your life. You grew up to that point, and that was it. And it was for no reason at all. It was pointless. And that was a Faustian wake-up call if I've ever seen one, never mind World War II.
Yeah, it's this serious divide. Like, certain works become popular for a reason, and Faust is popular for a reason. It's basically God versus man. And it's, you have to choose your intellect versus your experience. It's a split down the middle, essentially, an opposites problem. And in World War One, of course, you could divide that bargain up in many, many different ways. But the point of this is, it's God or it's Satan. And everyone intuitively understands what that means. And if you haven't read the play, for example. But around this time, it's like 1913 to 1916, Jung had a dream. And there was this strange character. And here's a picture of him. This is an actual illustration painting by Jung that's in the Red Book. It was a vision of an old man with kingfisher wings that came to him, and it struck him as, like, it wasn't a dream that told him anything. It was a dream that made him feel something. It really resonated deep down inside of him. So he decided he was going to draw this picture and to really explore what this might mean. And if you notice the wings that he's got, for example, well, very, very soon after, during this period of time, he found a dead kingfisher in his garden. And kingfishers don't exist in Zurich.
Or if they do,
exceptionally rare. So he found one of these at the exact same time that you know, you can, of course, you can see the thing with the wings there.
No way is that true. Like,
yeah, it's quite a famous story of Jung's. It's ridiculous.
Do you have the one about the beetle? Sorry, do you have the one about the scarab beetle?
I can tell the story about the Scarab Beetle, but that's more synchronicity rather than the Red Book.
Well, I think that's pretty synchronicity what you just showed us. I guess layer it in there as well, just to show that stuff like this happened to you.
So, of course, we would call this in Jungian spheres, I guess, synchronicity, which is a meaningful coincidence. So you think of things taking place causally, normally, which is X causes Y. But there is another model which Jung put forward, but it's existed in ancient times as well, where things can happen concurrently, but they don't cause each other. So, for example, his dream didn't cause the dead kingfisher. They both happened concurrently because they stemmed from something else, as if the universe is a big symphony. And the archetypal, if you excuse the language example of this, was there was a patient who was very, very, very rational, all up in her head, that kept seeing Jung. And Jung was like, just read your dreams, sort some stuff out, stop being so rational. And she was like, I can't. And then she was sitting in Jung's therapy office one day, and she told him a dream that she had, which involved her finding a golden scarab beetle. And at the moment when she told that dream, Jung heard a knocking on the window behind him, and he turned around and he opened the window, and this scarab beetle flew in and he caught it. And he turned to his patient. He opened up his hand and said, "Here's your beetle." And that was enough to cause her to stop being so rational all the time, and it fixed her psychosis, essentially.
To be completely clear,
it wasn't a scarab beetle. It was a beetle that looked like a scarab beetle, but it was a beetle that wasn't native to the area. It was, again, an incredibly rare occurrence like this. So to happen at a period like that, you can make, of course, a statistical case that, well, maybe it's possible. But the point is, it was a very, very meaningful occurrence that human beings can't help but believe is... I mean, you know, there are loads of other examples like this too. There's a famous one, I can't remember exactly, where a guy visited a restaurant at three separate times. That was very meaningful to someone else who was also in the restaurant three separate times. They were years apart, and he ordered the same thing on the menu each time, and weird stuff. And they've done experiments where some of these things do happen above statistical norm. If you want to know more about this, I guess I don't have time to go into it here, but... Synchronicity and a causal connecting principle in Jung's collected works 8 covers some of the science behind this, as scientific as you can get on stuff like this, I guess.
Here we go, people. We're all in. This is, I guess this is something, yeah, like, look, let's not get into that. That's too much of a vista. But you see the realm we're in. We're in ghosts and synchronicities and all that. It's very interesting. So sorry, sir, continue.
Yeah, and you want to talk about ghosts. So a normal person would have this dream and encounter the kingfisher and go, "Huh, that's weird. I'm not going to sleep tonight." Jung decided he was going to talk to this character. And he understood that this character was actually Philemon, who we've already encountered here with his house burning down. And so he used to walk around his gardens, and he used to talk to this character. And this character would tell him many, many things that he did not understand. Now, what this character was filling in for him, just like in the story of Faust, was the non-rational part of his thinking. Because obviously Jung was locked into this particular aeon of time, I guess, if you want to put it like that, where everything was run by rationality and run by science. And what Philemon was telling him was, no, there's another world beyond that. Now, there are loads of other examples of Jung talking to these characters, but Philemon was the one that struck him very, very heavily, to the point where he built this castle, Bollingen Castle, and he inscribed that little quote up the top on one of the walls, which is Philemonis Sacrum Fausti, which in English, the best language, says Philemon's Shrine, Faust Repentance, which is very strange. It's like a mad scribbling you'd have from a prisoner on the wall. And there was a quote that he gave in the 1940s here. "I have taken over Faust as my heritage, and moreover as the advocate and avenger of Philemon, who, unlike Faust now the Superman, are the hosts of the gods in a ruthless and godforsaken age." essentially what's happening is you have... What happened in this particular scene was the scientific rational part of man killed the godlike part of man, and Jung decided that he was going to become the protector of that godlike part of man, that it needed to be saved from that burning. And that's what he dedicated his entire career to, was from these visions he was having at this time, but most importantly, to this character of Philemon. Now, one final thing I want to say in this particular part, and you'll like this, Stefan, because you're a Nietzsche boyo, is Philemon was a special type of vision for Jung, because you can have characters that pop up in dreams, and they might be a representation of the anima or of the shadow or of a past experience, but there's a certain special type which may be a projection of the self, we don't know, but it is the who you want to be, I guess would be the best way to put it, the ultimate extension of your personality if you were fully individuated. For Jung, it was Philemon, the wise old mystic man. Makes sense, because that's the image that we have of him. And he noticed that for Goethe, that was Faust, because Goethe was also a scientist writing around this time who had the same exact concerns as Faust. It took him 60 years to write it, and it ended up being one of the classics of world literature. It was a projection of him. That's why it was so good. And for Nietzsche, it was Zarathustra. Mm-hmm. Now, his criticism, I guess, towards Zarathustra was it was a shadow side of what was going on. So Jung called up Philemon so that he could converse with him, whereas Nietzsche didn't call up Zarathustra. Zarathustra called him down. And that's why Jung thought that Nietzsche went mad. That's a crude way of saying it, but that's essentially what happened, where it wasn't the ultimate extension of him. It was only the dark shadow side of him.
You want me to add in something hardcore as shit as well?
I would love you to.
The Germans didn't bring the Bible into World War I when they charged into those trenches. They brought Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Suck on that. That's crazy, isn't it?
Oh my God.
The Brits are like, these are all antichrists. Look what the fuck they're bringing with them. They're bringing this book about some mad German talking about like the end of Christianity and the death of God and all this stuff. And that's what they brought her into World War I, because that was when Faust was carrying them forward. And the Germans were by far the best army in that one. They were also the most mechanical in some sense. They all, like, before that, all the, you know, Napoleon, they dressed up in these elaborate suits, and it was all about like gentlemanness and all this. But the Germans were about results. They weren't about bullshit. So the Germans showed up all in gray. And what does gray look like? This is the first time people had ever seen this. This big wave of gray. That's a fucking robot, man. And that's what they came up. They went up and they fought like robots and they died like robots. And they were tough cookies. But and all, what are we talking about here? All this stuff, where does it come from? Nietzsche, Germany. Faust, Germany. Jung, sort of Germany. Like, it's all coming from this shit. So something super crazy went on with these boyos, man. I'm telling you something. Something crazy went on with it.
Well, at the very least, it's worthy of investigation, because why else would the literature that's produced around the time contain the themes that actually take place in the future, like immediately in the future? You could be reductionistic if you want to, but it's definitely worthy of investigation.
So I've just another thing before you rip into it there is to add to that as well. And this is something I want to say, people, if you want to do stuff like this, I recommend it. I recommend going for it. Just have just a bit more of a tame, like, art therapy approach to it, because this is essentially a key towards getting creativity. Like, look at it in a very basic first principles manner. Do you have a journaling practice? Maybe you could turn it more into like sprinkling some dreams. Are you focusing it on creating something? I guess the big thing that pulls this all together is, do you have a craft? Like, a big deal for me when I was reading my dreams is a lot of this channel, by the way, came from the stuff that I learned from doing that. Like the archetype of the kingdom, the archetype of the mountain, which just blew James's mind when I told him about it.
That's one of the top five genius moments of Western civilization. It's unbelievable what you achieved there.
Speaking of synchronicities, look at the picture. Like, it all makes sense, man. I'm telling you, it's just, it all snaps into place. This is the moment for it all. But a lot of that stuff, and a lot of the music and the stories and all the characters and all this stuff that I'd be playing around with, they come from that stuff. And I kind of feel it's weird. I feel like I have 20, 30, 40 years of content to play with now. And I look forward to the future, the more I can flesh it out. It looks great. And it's a very interesting place to be, because you kind of meet artists and they're like, oh, I have no ideas. Oh, I've got to go more. I got to go on the holidays to get inspiration. And I'm like, I've too much. I've too much. It'll take too long to develop it and all that stuff. So it's super interesting. It's a cool thing to have. And Jung is sort of saying, you've got this supercomputer back here. You can access it. Look what I did when I accessed it. I met Satan. Maybe you don't want that, but you could do something like start pulling out, analyzing your dreams or whatever. What's interesting is how we understand this, because when you start dancing in this realm, when you start getting into this kind of funky stuff, you realize that the whole
pulling stuff out of the unconscious doesn't happen in a nice rational way. Like when I try make a song and I'm like, right, I'll do it like by the laws of music that I've studied, it turns out shit always because I try to rationalize it. But then when you are digging in these areas and you're kind of giving yourself over, it's almost felt in some sense. It's almost like you discover stuff. And so again, a note on Zarathustra, Nietzsche wrote those four books 10 days each. He said he just like woke up and he just scribbled like a seance nearly. And he churned out Zarathustra. If you read Zarathustra, it's some of the best writing you'll ever read. But it's a little bit kind of clunky. But when you read through it, it almost comes across as like, whoa, dude. It's like together in this really smart way. Like some of the zinger one-liners he has in that are amazing. Me and James have done a video on this. Like I recommend you check it out. There's some passages that are just like bang, bang, like full punching the best you could ever imagine. And it is that idea of like, do you have a craft that you can focus your stuff on? Are you working on it for a long time? And are you digging into this unconscious and seeing what you can kind of get? And also understanding that there is this sense of giving yourself over to it. You sort of have to loosen up your hands and allow yourself to discover, see it as a discovery. I guess what I'm trying to push here is that this is an incredible book and study of knowledge to understand the artistic process. And whether you are an army general, an athlete, an intellectual, an entrepreneur, an artist especially, like this could all be useful. You never know. This is how the human mind works. Play with that shit. And just one last thing before we bounce back onto it is that there's some amazing stuff about this. Like Jung in The Archetypes of the Collective Unconscious, I recommend you check it out. He has this series of mandalas that he gets one of his patients to draw. So a woman comes to him and she has this attitude. And this is the right attitude, I think. She says, okay, cool, I get this archetype thing. I get all this stuff. You want to individuate. I get the mythology. I understand what you're saying. Your stuff is very interesting. But I want to do it. I want to do it for myself. How do I achieve this? I don't want to learn anymore. I want to do. I want to be empirical. And that's a great attitude to have because you're putting this stuff to the test and you're going through, you're living it because that's what you're here for. And so Jung says, all right, start this way. Start painting circles. Start painting mandalas and kind of feel your way into them. And so she's never painted before and her first one's like shit. It's like a little, it's like what you'd imagine a Southern puffter would draw. Like it's just like blotches of crappy paints and all this.
Oh, I tried to draw a mandala the other day. It was absolutely disgusting. It was just repulsive.
Yeah, it looks like a Tesco pancake or something like that. You're like, it's terrible. And she has to explain. She's like, oh, this is, you know, this happened and all that. Then the next one, interesting, is a little bit better. And Jung says to her, you know, let your inner eye guide you. If it doesn't look right, don't do it. Make it do what looks right. And I've noticed with music sometimes is that you kind of don't think. What happens is you're kind of listening to something. You're like, no, that doesn't fit. And then there's you do something and it fits. And you're like, all right, keep doing it. And it's like you're sculpting in a way. It's very, very strange. And she started doing this. She was a shit painter. By the end of it, like the cover of the book has one of them on it. By the end of it, she's drawing these beautiful mandalas, like Buddhist level shit. Well, okay, maybe not that good, but you know what I mean? It's like she learned how to paint and all she did was just let her hand follow her mind. And it was like there was something super ordinate that once she could get her rational mind out of the way, it worked through her. And so in some sense, if you want to talk Red Book and all this stuff, or you want to talk freeing yourself, developing character, personality, you have to learn how to access that and get out of your own way. And this is what I think Jung achieved too much. He's like, it all came forward and pushed him into madness. And maybe Nietzsche was the same. You don't know.
Well, yeah. And not everyone's going to be able to do it on this level. Like, I think that's why openness as a dimension exists, because like you take the average Northman sitting in the pub, like he ain't going to do this. You go up to him and say, make a Red Book. You're like, what? It ain't gonna happen. So some people seem to be more in tune to that bleeding over of the unconscious, which is why I think it's really important to emphasize, is the point we both made earlier, what you do in the real world, we'll say this world, mirrors what you're doing in the spiritual world. And that happens in your own personal mythology, of course. You have dreams about your fears and you go and encounter your fears. On a more collective level, these Faustian problems, this picture on the screen right now is going on in the European soul this very second. It's a collective drama that we all have, and not everyone's going to be up to solving that problem. Like I'm not up to solving that problem, for example, but some characters I guess are, and they're the more visionary prophetic types, and so that type of deep Red Book stuff is left for them. But not even Nietzsche could handle that type of thing. You know, no one knows what killed Nietzsche. No one does. So it's open for interpretation, but quite possibly it could have been a problem like this.
That's very interesting, because you say that that's going on to the European soul, and most people aren't up to fighting against it. But in a very, very scary way, despite the fact that most people don't even care about this Faustian drama going on in the European soul. In situations like World War One, a lot of people died because of these memes. Like I think I've said before, this is a, I was going to say this is another mountain thing, but in some sense, history is like a war between memes, between big ideas. And all the humans are in some sense the cannon fodder. And it's a very, very strange feeling to think of it this way, that the collective swirls above us like gods. And as the Greeks saw us, we're merely just play pieces in this funny drama that they're controlling in some sense. It's a very, very interesting thought. So keep going, sir, by all means.
Yeah, move on to this final part of this presentation. Now, I hope you've enjoyed so far. I hope you've been sitting comfortably. Yes. This is all about how to make your own red book, if you are so inclined. Of course, we have to have another quote to introduce this. Until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate. So we're talking about shamans for a second, Stefan. So shamans are weird people by Western standards, because most people would look at them, if they think about them at all, and go, they're kind of insane. Because what the hell are they doing? They're talking to spirits, right? That's not a normal thing people to do. So are they wrong? Is what they're doing a waste of time? You've got to ask yourself that question. Even if you take an evolutionary biology standpoint, why would these practices have evolved? Like, it's just obscure. So Jung's approach to these was, yeah, shamans, they have a lot of psychosis. They're not the most mentally healthy people, but they literally have perceptual differences to the standard Westerner. It's as if their psyche is not less evolved, is differently evolved, is in a different version of, it's as if there are different software updates you could have for your own psyche, and they're in a different one to us. So they're able to perceive the unconscious far more readily than us, including in a waking state. So that's basically what we're going to try and do, is to make you into a shaman, essentially. Part-time, of course, because for a Westerner to go to a shaman would take a lot of stuff, and I doubt anyone's going to be interested in going and do that. So the first step, if you want to make your own red book, and this is really interesting to find out anyway, I'm interested to see what you are, Stefan, in this, to determine if you're an audio person or if you are a visual person. Visual. So you're a visual person. So I want to ask you this, actually. When you close your eyes, can you see things?
Well, not right now. It's quite black. But if I think very visually, very visually.
Okay. What detail are those pictures in?
God, it's been a while since I've done it, like properly paid attention to my thoughts. You know, it actually depends on what I'm doing. Because if I'm writing, it becomes out. I become very word obsessed. But it's sometimes I'll find myself drawing pictures to understand what I'm doing. But if I sit down and I like visualize, I can see stuff that's movie quality. But it's not like, it's almost like it's like misty. It's faint. It's not like I can go in there and I'm watching a movie. It's like there's. It's almost like a dream, I guess you could say. It's not very, very vibrant and present, but it's. It's like the imprints of that on this like shadowy darkness. I guess you could say it's like the way if you went into a cave, you know, an ancient cave with the cave paintings, the way you'd experience those paintings, they like glimmer, they flicker. That's the way I see things in my mind, I guess is the best way to say it.
Okay, that's interesting. Because I was speaking to a dude in the Oboyo Discord, and he says that he can see vividly, like very, very vividly when he closes his eyes. Whereas I can't see anything. It's either complete blackness or it's a static frame with no colors in it whatsoever. And if it's moving, if it's like a movie picture, it's completely wrong speed. So if I try and imagine something, it's either going too fast, too slow, I can't make anything out. Like if I close my eyes, I can't picture what you look like unless I try and visualize a previous video you've been on, for example, and I might get an occasional flash. But for me, it's all words.
Well, that's interesting, because I was probably more, I guess, it's weird, dude. Like, I guess you could say I was more word heavy when I was younger, but then I got into stuff like this. Like when I started dream reading, dude, like there's this really weird thing that will happen to you if you start doing this, is that you will go into your dreams and you will pull out what we could call like a Philemon, a vibrant character, a vibrant meme, if you want to put it that way. And what that will do, it's almost like a cup of coffee. It sets your mind on fire. And then suddenly your head, it's almost like you've burst a hole into Narnia. And suddenly all these visions and images start to pop out. And it's not like elaborate. It's not like you start seeing shit. But maybe if you were more sensitive, you would. But what would happen to me then is I just get caught up in a series of ideas that are very visually profound. and it's sometimes more than what I'm used to, and it's almost like I'm tapping into the visual part of my brain more. And I don't think there's this like I'm a visual thinker, I'm a word thinker. I think you just have to learn to cross those boundaries in some sense, because I would have been more word thinkers and things would have been a lot darker. And then I remember I took some LSD at one point, and for a couple of months after that, dude, actually, to be honest, this is weird, it's almost like I got there and then I had it forever in some sense. Like ever since that moment, I remember being quite it was maybe it shined a bit more is the only way you could describe it. It's a very, very weird feeling. And yeah, it was more potent is the only way I could say. And then the dream reading just took it up another level, I'd say. And then I sometimes I'm in a different mode, sometimes in another mode. And it's almost like a focus thing, I guess. So I don't know. I don't really know how to describe that. It's just me riffing on my experience.
There are distinct differences. Like people do think in these two different tones, I guess. There's not a huge amount of research from what I understand into what this is, because it's very difficult to get people to describe what they see when their eyes are closed, and to have control studies. It's very, very difficult.
Yeah.
But so if depending on what you are is depending on what kind of method that you're going to do. So that's very, very important. The next thing you're going to do is to go into what's called a hypnagogic state. That sounds very fancy. A hypnagogic state is where you are between waking and sleeping. So that sort of misty, groggy feeling when you have a lie-in on a Saturday morning and you like the time just disappears and you don't really feel you're asleep or awake, and you get quite vivid dreams that come up in that state. That is where you want to be, because you're awake, but the unconscious can come forth. It's as if, and some scientists classify this actually, that we don't have sleep and wake. We have three states: sleep, hypnagogic, and awake, which is very, very strange to consider. Now, a disclaimer on stuff like this, and I suffer from this really, really badly, is sleep paralysis. When you have sleep paralysis, that's where you are, is in that hypnagogic state. And because you're coming out of sleep into awake or vice versa, you've gone too far, so your body becomes paralyzed. But the hallucinations that you always get, or those demon women that come after you if you suffer from this, those are the visions that come up. And so this is why you can understand, I guess, when Jung said, I guess you should have said this earlier, his visions became so intense when he was having them that he had to hold on to his chair to stop him being dragged into hell as tight as he possibly could, and used to have to keep repeating to himself, my name is Carl Gustav Jung.
Oh my God.
At XYZ Street. I have a wife. I have three kids. Ah!
He slept with
reminding himself he was real and awake and not living in the dream world.
He slept with a gun under his pillow for a while, didn't he?
I'm not aware of that one. What, so he can shoot?
You haven't heard of this one, dude. Yeah, there was some point where he this got so intense that he started sleeping with a gun under his, or maybe it was in his drawer or under his pillow, and he was just saying to himself, like, this is, I think I'm actually going insane, and if it gets too intense, I'm just gonna fucking, Nietzsche has a quote that kind of explains where he's been, the thought of suicide helps many men get through many long nights. And it's that type of idea. It's like, this is, I'd rather die than face whatever the fuck this shit is. Like, for example, see this photo here from Greg's at Friday night at 3 a.m. Like, you just don't want to be stuck there for too long. You want to get the fuck out. So sometimes the gun can be the path.
Well, yeah, it goes to show how terrifying it is. I've had, when I have sleep paralysis, normally it's just I can't move, but sometimes I get horrific visions where it's always like this witch woman that grabs me around the throat and I will panic. And they're actually getting more hallucinogenic as I grow older. I thought it would have been the other way around as imagination dies. Well, I actually hallucinate that I've fallen on the floor and gotten up and I'm running around screaming. And I feel like I'm fucking my entire life up. But then I'll wake up again like 2 minutes later and go, oh, thank God for that. And I get really angry with my fiance, because I'm like moving my body around and it's as if she's not like assisting me. And it really, really, really pisses me off. But once you get yourself into that state, preferably not being covered by demons, you'll notice that you'll start to visualize things if you are a visual thinker, or you'll start to hear things if you are a more audio thinker. Because, and this is of course a meditative technique, which is to quiet your mind, and it can either be images or words that come across you. What you want to do is get to the point where you are in that state but focused, and when something crosses your perceptual field, either words or images, you want to focus on it as if your eye was like a telescope. Move it in, like focus on it, and so then it will come into focus.
So you're saying you would hear words. So
me, when I do, I was about to say, I guess, I hear words.
Okay, that's interesting. I thought you meant when you try to visualize things, you like see like text.
No.
No, so that's interesting because maybe that's why I've sort of that blend. Because like, if you do music a lot, like music's not like we can't call music visual. Although I've noticed that music makes me visualize, but you'll sit there and you'll have this very audio experience, and it is very weird. And so that's like a mode. It's weird. I almost like flip between those two modes. What I'd really love to do is somehow blend storytelling and music together. And because it's almost like the visuals of movies married with the, I guess you could say, the musicality of something like operas and all that. It's a very interesting idea, but it is like crossing those two senses. But I didn't quite understand that you meant that you'd sit down and you'd hear words. That's very crazy. Okay.
Yeah.
So
and
that seems like
really
a different... It's what, sorry?
It's horrific because I'm there. I'm like in the middle of the night or whatever. I tried to do this for a while back. I've stopped because it's really creepy and I've got too many things to do to be fucking around with spirits. But I would get to that point and then I would hear, like, it's always a female voice actually just saying a few words to me because I'm not very good at it. I've only just started. And it would just be a few words that didn't make any sense, crystal clear as if it was someone right next to my ear.
Oh man, that's so fucking creepy because that's happened to me a few times before and I've just dismissed it as like, oh no, dude, why did you tell me? I don't need to know that. Why did... Fuck.
Well, no. Okay. I'm not saying it's a spirit. I'm saying...
Yeah, but you just told me at the start it is the young are haunted. Don't tell me you can't tell me it's not a spirit.
Well, okay. Yeah,
stop being nice to me.
We don't know where that divide is between the two. But if you're a more imagistic person, an image will cross your mind. And then if you focus on it, it then becomes as if you were with your eyes open. It becomes completely and utterly crystal clear.
Oh,
and then if you can hold it there, I haven't gone further than this, but the method just repeats itself. If you can hold it there, then you can actually begin to walk through the dream as if it was lucid deliberately. And then characters will appear and then you talk to them.
Jesus.
So with me, it would be hearing voices and talking to them. I imagine there'd be a slight visual aid at the same time. Now, if you're very serious about doing this, you can get into the occult if you want to. Again, I do not recommend doing this. But Jung, he gets again a bad rap with more Christian circles for a multitude of reasons, one of which it was he dabbled in the occult, but he did it in a psychological scientific phenomena. He was like, why is this thing popular if it's bollocks? And then he realized, again, what it was a tool in order to call up the unconscious. And there are very weird different techniques you can do that occultists use to train themselves to talk to spirits. And one of them, and which is so weird, and this is, again, why people don't do it. One of them is to train yourself so that you can stare at the wall for an hour without blinking. And what that does is it trains your focus. So when you're there trying to watch for those images to cross your mind, you can focus as hard as you possibly can. So it's training. You know, it's as if there's a big coliseum or like a video game and there are successive levels of stuff. You've got to go through the trials first before you actually get there. So once you do this, the first thing that you want to do is to write down what happened, because dreams will either fade or you will start to post hoc change what happened in the dream. Especially if you're into dream analysis anyway and you're looking to solve a particular problem, you'll start taking the images and stuff that you found and be like, oh, well, that must have meant that this is the poor relationship with my mother, when it might not have done, for example. So write down precisely what happens. And then...
I just want to tell the people in the podcast the utter darkness of this humor here. James has something called a boyo journal on the screen, and he has like four things noted down, which the boyo must do. So the first one is become juicy as fuck. The second one is get tattoo of Carl's face on top of my own face. And we're like, what the fuck is this? Find Carl's grave so I can take him home. And then call mom. Find Carl's grave so I can take him home. What are you trying to say? Do you want to dig Carl Jung up and bring him home and stick
him
in your house?
You're the one who said that, not me. This isn't my journal. This is a boy who sent this in, of course. It'd be nice, of course, to take.
Well,
to
no,
take
if home. I had problems with getting haunted, I don't think I want to just dig up Carl Jung, of all people, Carl Jung's fucking corpse and stick it in my room, like, and then I'm going to sleep and I'm like, oh, I'm hearing voices. Oh, what's this? Oh, it's probably nothing. And then Carl's just like, you fucking idiot, put me back, or I swear to God, like, you'll have Faust living in your, you'll have Faust living in your shower for the rest of your life.
Yeah, apparently he used to create like relics and weird things in his spare time because he was a strange man, and occultists are known to go up to them and then run away from them because apparently they are very, very, very powerful relics that he created.
Oh my god.
And they're like, we can't touch this. He's like high wizard supreme. So yeah, his corpse probably has some anti-necromancy spells around them. You can't just sort of put it in your bed next to you to keep him warm, because it probably is very cold in the grave. I merely meant this in a benevolent way, I guess. So that's what you need to do. You need to write things down, and then the final step, and this is a very powerful step to activate different parts of your brain, I don't know the specifics, of course, is to paint what you saw. So what that original image I showed you of Philemon was a drawing that Jung did, a painting. And he actually painted that whole thing again on the wall of his Bollingen castle. So paint what you saw. And when you painted different themes, apparently, because I've not got this far yet because it's terrifying, different themes will start to jump out to you.
Yeah.
Because when you visualize something, it's very different to just thinking about it. You draw all your thoughts out onto the page.
This genuinely does happen. Like, I did that from dream reading, and it's very profound. Stuff starts to show up, and it becomes very vibrant, and it really, really, it's punchy. It sticks out. Like, as I was saying, this whole idea, like, oh, the mountain archetype and all this. Like, before I understood that Jung was like, everybody sees that, I sort of started to hit on it myself, and I was like, wow, there's something really interesting about this. And it became very vibrant, and I'd like draw pictures of the mountains and have like little scenarios and the kingdom and all this stuff, and it was all coming, and I was like, wow, this is very, very crazy. And they were, I guess you could say, it was very interesting for me to find these by myself and then go into Jung and have him actually reaffirm it and hear people talk about it again. I was like, whoa, that is very strange, man. And these things coagulate in a very strange way. So yeah, there's something definitely that goes on there.
Yeah, yeah. And this is basically the same thing as dream reading. So identical. If you want to do this stuff, but you don't want to go and summon spirits into your life, then dream reading is probably the best thing for you to do. Going and making your own red book will be more beneficial, more fleshy. You actually live it. It's like really living within a movie, whereas dream reading is watching a movie later after the consciousness editing has gone over the top of it. So if you want to get into Jung practically, start with dream reading. And then if you actually lose your mind, then you can move on and making your own red book.
Yes, I believe Jung also said that dream reading is, it's almost like, I guess you could say, eating healthy and going to the gym versus steroids or something like that. And it's like, steroids could fuck you up long term. You'll definitely get results though, but it could fuck you up long term. Whereas, you know, if you just keep at it for a long time, you'll get serious benefits. So that's why I chose dream reading over like another one is taking drugs, dude. If you do psychedelics, as Jung said, beware of wisdom you do not earn. Like, it'll take you there. It'll take you to these spots, but you just don't know. You just don't know what's coming out. You know what I mean? Like, you don't know if, you don't know if fucking Faust or just like, you know, the Uber or the anti-Norf is in there just waiting for you at some point. So you just gotta be careful.
Do you reckon Uber Boyo is that version of you? That's your version of Zarathustra. It just sounds like a porn star.
I've gotten a lot of comments like along those lines. That's interesting. A lot of people are just like, I think it's funny. I think it's funny. That's the only reason I went for that. I just think it's so gas.
Well,
in
English, it would be Super Boyo, and that does have a very dodgy vibe to it.
What do you mean dodgy? I always just think it's another, I guess the vibe we talk about in this channel, it's like we're just, you know, you get just people like Jordan Peterson, who's very, very serious and somber, but like, oh man, you just don't understand how meaningful life really is. And we're just like, yeah, Jung almost went insane from like ghost, man. What you think about that? That's crazy. Norfs, Gregs, oh my god. I kind of think it's like that energy pulled out of, I guess you could say, I've got brooding sides, I've got sadder sides, I've got more profound deep sides, I've got more lighthearted, like, you know, and then my lighthearted side, if you just abstract it out, I think it turns into the Uber Boyo. But I do understand though at the same time that it has that tie to Nietzsche, which always punches it in that direction of like the dangerous going too far. Yeah. So I don't know, maybe dude, by all means, maybe.
Yeah, so maybe, I hope so. That'd be very, very, very entertaining to see.
If you want to hear of me developing one of these characters, go into some of the music and look up, I think one of the ones is called Diabolos, and then the most recent one is called Black Soul. Yes. Listen to those two, they're pretty much the same character, and I just explored them, and it's weird, like, I know that stuff is so, it's nearly like, it's evil, like, it's just the baddest intentions you could imagine, it's insulting, it's degenerate, all those type of things, but I guess I can kind of get in the zone with it and just allow it to speak its voice, because I know it's not like a representative of my thoughts per se. It's almost like a dark corner
of the mind or something like that. I find it very interesting, and it's almost like I'm fleshing out a character, and I wonder what that character does or where it lives or who it is. And I kind of see flashes of this character in other people as well, but this is something that lives by itself, and it's a weird thing in that sense.
Yeah, that's one of the first things that I found when we first got in contact. I was like, oh, who's this Uber Boyo bloke? He weren't called Uber Boyo then, of course. And I was like, oh, he's got makes music. That's really nice. And one of the only songs you had up at the time was you in a satanic voice going, fucking kill the virgins. Let me drink their fucking blood. And I was like, what am I got myself in for? This is disgusting.
Yeah, it's weird. And then when I listen back to those, I hear visions flash from my mind. Like, I see stuff. It's almost like it's opening something up like that. And I wonder what it is. Like, is that a part of me that if I, you know, became a... like a state leader or something like that, would I be standing in front, or a revolutionary or something like that, would I be standing, because I see like images of something like the communist revolution going on there, or maybe that type of energy of like overthrow of order and all this stuff, and it's a very, very strange feeling. And then on the flip side, there's also this feeling of like, I guess you could call it the Dionysian energy, but I don't know what it means, and I don't know, is it me, or is it me just like seeing something that's currently alive in the age? Because I think that could be possible as well. It's weird, like there does seem to be that energy of desire for overthrow starting to kind of ranch up again, that's been kept quiet for quite a long time. So I don't know, and this is what's really weird about it. Something like that will come out, I don't have a fucking clue what it is, man. Like, my rational mind can't explain it, but you've got like what is that? What's going on there? And why is it so, I don't know, potent in a weird way? It's very strange.
Yeah, very, very, very strange indeed. But unfortunately, it's time to end talking about spirits. So yeah. I had to delve into some juicy Q&A. So first of all, I'm going to show you this picture, Stefan. I want to ask you, what does this picture remind you of?
The spirituous picture.
Don't even read the text. Just what does the picture remind you of?
This picture makes me think of dragons, makes me think of chaos, the medieval times. I keep wanting to try to make North jokes out of it, but I really can't with this one. This is like me, mate, on a Monday morning, yeah, after like fucking a whole weekend of calling and Greg's, man. This is what I feel like, mate.
I'm trying to stall for time, because I'm trying to actually pull what the actual question is that's up.
Right. Well, one thing I will say that we didn't mention, if we're stalling for time, is James is going to start up his channel again. And we have this thing where we're hitting on like a huge vista of knowledge. And in some sense, I want to focus on the artistic side of things, the creative side of things, and that type of stuff. And I want to take it in that direction. And James wants to do the work of studying and all that as well. He wants to keep going with like exploring the Western canon and all that. And I'm not adverse to that at all, but you only have so much time. You got to make sacrifices. But luckily we got like a load of used dudes who actually really like what's going on. So we're going to start splitting things off, or maybe have one or two, maybe three more channels popping up. You never know. We'll see what happens anyway. And it'll be covering angles all related to the general vibe. We want to keep the vibe up and positive and all that. But Jimmy's going to start up his channel again, start putting content out there. I'm not quite sure. He has something planned for September. That's all I can tell you. So by all means, we'll link it down in the comments. I'll pin it as the top comment. Pop down in there and hop over to that channel. Subscribe to that as well. And you'll start getting new, fresh takes, more Jimmy takes. And I'll even show up in that channel, I'm sure, plenty of times as well. And we'll start...
not invited on the channel. That's the reason why I'm leaving.
I'll dress up as a North, and he'll like literally come in and be like, God, I love you, like you're perfect, you're so much better than that other guy I remember. And I'll be like, yeah, typical, like, of course.
This is when I join Jung and get a gun for under my pillow. Come anywhere near my house is the end of everything. yeah, that was a very nice casual plug, I guess. So basically there's gonna be more content, double the amount of content. If you enjoyed the Ion series, if you enjoy stuff like this, you're gonna get more of that over on the Jimmy Boyo channel. So
yes,
might as well go and subscribe, and then that can nourish your soul in this horrible world of death and nihilism and the Norths. I found the question, though. I found it. It's kind of a strange question. So this image, if you weren't quite sure, is from the first page of Psychology and Alchemy by Carl Gustav Jung. Many of our subconsciously recurring motifs are variations of Western alchemical concepts, which in turn are derived from earlier religious symbolism and other primordial biological human instincts. I agree, Invictus. I agree. This drawing shows a union between the sun and the moon in the house of Venus to form the element of Mercury. Looking for behavioral advice here, so listen up, Stefan. Is the revealing spirit of clarity, or Mercury, found in the passionate pursuit, house of Venus? And in what way do you think the sun and the moon are connected here in the quaternity?
Jesus. One thing I will say is that alchemy is almost like the Western people's red book. There's a cool way to think about it.
Yes, actually. Yeah, that is a good way to think about it.
Imagine it like the Europeans going schizophrenic. And what's interesting is that everybody's schizophrenic all the time in this type of scale. We all have this like dream world, this underworld. And so in some sense, that's what alchemy was doing. They were trying to cover that angle. And that was getting married to the way more rational, straightforward Catholic Church. So it's a very interesting dance. What they might be saying through these symbols, the pursuit of clarity, is that what Invictus was asking?
Yeah, so the core question here is the revealing spirit of clarity found in the passionate pursuit. Do you get clarity through pursuing something you're passionate about, I think is the question.
Yeah, no, I think I know what he's saying. It kind of comes down to what I was saying earlier, is that I think that's like obvious. This is an interesting thing, because I've been thinking about this a lot recently, is that the idea of what knowledge is, because is like, I guess you could say that here we get into epistemology and all that, is knowledge an end in and of itself? Because you might get someone like Jung, who seems to be quite a knowledge worker in some sense, but what is the purpose of discovering all this stuff? And this is why I say, I think the best way to go into this field is to try create something. This is what I like to do. It makes me feel better doing this way, because in the end, when you have something to show for your knowledge, you can kind of understand the point was not to know. The point was to know through doing, in some sense. I call it empirical. You can say it empiricism in that sense. Experience it. And then this is not a new idea. Like, I'm not coming up with anything new here, unlike the mountain archetype. You can
That's
even think
shit. That blows me away every time you bring
I know.
That up.
I got a
loin shiver.
your loins react.
I can't help it. It's just a visceral boost of libido, I guess. It's actually quite disgusting.
If you think about it, James, I'm going to curse you forever right now. But if you think about it, the beautiful womanly form towards a woman's loins is almost like a mountain that's upside down. Bet you never thought of that before.
That's very, very intelligent. I like that. So okay. is that where this came from? I'm actually interested in how you came up with the archetype of the mountain. Were you masturbating?
And the picture I was looking at was upside down. I was like, wait a second. And you know, wait, at the top of the mountain is where the highest value is. Like, if you think about it, dude, there's something to do with this. Holy shit, we're kind of getting on a tangent now, but the old alchemical symbol for male was a mountain that was pointing upwards, and the female was a mountain pointing downwards. So hey, who knows, man? Who knows?
Yeah, can we ditch this question and just talk more about mountain vag?
mountain vag. And back to what I was saying. Oh, damn, I've sort of forgot it. This actually relates to this a lot. The old way they used to talk about having sex was they'd say he knew his wife. He was to know her. He Adam knew Eve, and they had a son. Adam knew her. He knew her. He knew a lot of chicks, like that type of thing. And I think that does perfect testament to what you're asking, is that it's almost like the romantic way of seeing the world, is that you live the peak moments. Like, did Nietzsche have that great moment of clarity when with Zarathustra? What was that all about? Was that him about actually experiencing what it was like to fully give himself over to Zarathustra? And was that his knowledge? Because in a weird way, you think you want to understand, but what we're actually describing here is that, you know, in this moment where Nietzsche got his peak work, his greatest work, where he could understand everything, when he was writing Zarathustra, it wasn't even him. His rational mind was off. The knowing mind was over, and it was an experience that he had. And after that, he could reflect on it, and that was probably the best he could get. And so in some sense, yes, I think overwhelmingly it pushes to, it's empirical. Most definitely, you got to do it. And it's almost like you got to climb that mountain, and it might be through a craft or anything, But reaching that is when you will know, and it's an experience.
Mm, yes, yes, indeed. So to address, I guess, what this might mean, Invictus, when you have a quaternity symbolism, obviously it's four, so you've got these, it makes a cross symbol. But the magical thing about a quaternity is three parts are made whole by the fourth. So it's as if the three are contained within that fourth part. So you've got the sun, the moon, and then you've actually got the sun and the moon conjunct together, and the missing piece is Mercurius. So as to what that might mean, I cannot tell you. I guarantee that the book will be able to tell you. So off the top of my head, I don't know. As for the behavioral stuff, what Stefan said answers that first question very nicely. But as for the reference to the sun and the moon together, if you look at Jungian alchemy in particular, especially someone like Liz Green, if you're interested in this stuff, I would recommend you look up Liz Green. There are loads of different schools of alchemy, but that's one I think is the most robust, for as robust as you can make these type of things. The sun has a distinct purpose as being the solar hero, someone like Helios or even like a Lion King symbolism, because the sun is in Leo. So you've got the hero, your outward projection. And of course, wherever your sun lands in your birth chart, that's who you're meant to become. And you get there via your rising sign. So there are, again, other schools of astrology will interpret that differently, but that's the Liz Green way of doing it. Whereas the moon is the opposite to that. It's more your internal journey, your emotional side, those more complicated internal feelings. And that can become more of a problem for you, for example, if you have your moon in Scorpio, is one where that really becomes a problem for you. It starts tearing you apart, where you can go out into the world and you can act, but you're pulled back by this. So you can see that the sun and the moon in many ways are two different opposites together. That one is outwards, one is inwards. So if you want to translate this onto this, you've got one out, one in, then you've got two of them conjunct together. So bringing them together, and then you form the little baby, which is Mercurius. Mercurius, or Mercury, I believe, is also at home in Leo, if I remember correctly, which is the house of the sun. So that's something else. But so that, I hope those thoughts clear things up. I'd recommend them actually reading the book rather than going for us on real deep stuff like this. So got another question for you, Stefan, and this involves one of your favorite things, Kundalini. And we got a very long question from our good friend Hammer over in the Discord, but I think the best way to approach this is, what do you think of Kundalini?
Let's see if we can get a picture of us there, by the way. Oh jeez, there we are. I'm just screwing around with this a bit more.
That, oh yeah, just this strange OBS stuff that you're using.
Yeah, let's see. Okay, that looks absolutely awful.
You are recording this as well, by the way, right?
Yeah, well, I can cut that part out. Okay, right.
Well, no. I mean, in general, you are recording.
Oh, most definitely. It says.
Okay, sweet. Good.
No, that's awful. It looks terrible. I wonder, could we pop? We'll try this. I just can't get it. Do you know how to get it to switch between on?
On Zoom.
Yeah. Do you need screen share anymore?
Nope.
Okay, sweet. You can't get it to switch between on Zoom?
Mm-hmm.
No. Do you know how to get that, where if one of us talks, it kind of pops to us?
Yeah, I've it took me a while to find it before. Let me try and look for you.
Silently start, but what am I?
Oh, is it like that? Gallery view to speak of you?
No.
I can't be helping you there then.
Damn.
You just zoomed in on your face.
Yeah, no, I clicked something wrong. Zoom in on your face. Spotlight. Spotlight when I speak. Please talk, James.
Hello there. Hello.
Beautiful. Oh, I think we've got it. I think we've got it now. Does it alternate? Yeah, it does. Okay, that's good. Okay, that's the job. Why is it?
Make sure that part was cut out, and then off you go.
Okay, sweet. So what we're talking about here is so the question was from...
it's from Hammer. There's a long question, but I think the best way to answer is just, what do you think of the Kundalini? Is it good or bad? Do you play around with it? What do you think?
I think we've talked about it before, where the very, very difficult thing for us to do is understand what these people are talking about when they're describing these phenomena. So we would quite we would make the mistake of assuming that Kundalini is some mystical force before we understand perhaps its materialistic manifestation. Maybe it's smarter for us to pay a bit of attention to how it turns out practically. What's the most practical version of Kundalini you can think about? It's the sexual instinct. It's the libido. Mm. It's the juice, the boyo juice, as we talked about before. So if you want to get into Kundalini and all that, but you haven't got, shall we say, the utmost libido hygiene, you haven't got your boyo juice under control, you're probably kind of going into nonsense land. Like, you're probably kind of getting a bit ahead of yourself. You're trying to run before you can walk, that type of thing. And like, if you study something like yoga has its 8 pillars, and one of the first pillars, you think yoga is like, oh, you know, do a backflip and all that stuff. Like, for example, the physical part of yoga is only one chunk of the entire 8 legs of yoga, I think they call it, or arms it could be. So if you want to get into something like Kundalini or yoga, it comes with stuff like, yoga talks about being a moral person. You're not allowed getting into the advanced yoga until you're, you know, not a pain, you're not a problem in your society. You got to have your diet in order. Like, they're very practical in that sense. And so when you're getting into stuff like Kundalini and you're saying, oh, I want to release the snake so it comes up into my mind and gives me enlightenment and all that from doing yoga moves, perhaps, maybe that's the way you go into it. It's sort of like, maybe you can think of it more simply, like, what's your relationship to sexuality? There's a question. How are you dealing with that? Are you perhaps too loose with it? Are you too strict with it? Are you kind of, have you got energy around it? Are you a bit ashamed about it? Are you unable to be ashamed about it? Like, what's going on here? What's your situation? Are you able to actually say to yourself, okay, right, I'm gonna, you know, rein it in for maybe a month. Could you do a month without any contact in that sense? Could you do something like that? Could you do a traditional understanding of chastity? And then maybe you will begin to understand that from controlling that energy, it opens up your ability to think clearer or think different at the very least, or maybe changing your energies. Like, this is anecdotal now. This is just boyo talk, but I've heard boyos discuss them not releasing their boyo juice for a couple of months. And then they start to have this weird thing where they notice synchronicities more. And then they notice they're more creative and stuff like this. And it's like, well, what does that mean? I don't know, bro. I'm no expert in this stuff.
But well, it would explain why priests aren't allowed to nut, get you as close to God as humanly possible. Okay. Now, we're not saying, of course, that semen gives you magic powers, but that's also kind of what we're saying. That you shouldn't be. You should treat it like a precious reservoir. You shouldn't share it with people willy nilly. Not your friends. Not your extended family. Not your close family. You should keep it to yourself, is what we're saying.
don't be loose with the juice. Do not be loose with the juice. Well, that's something to understand. So if you were asking about Kundalini, I'd recommend you try go to its most simplest manifestation. Nietzsche actually discusses this. Don't try make things more complicated than they are. They probably have a basic biological reason that they exist in that way, and look into that. And then from there, you can start to say to yourself, well, maybe there is something mystical about the libido energy, and maybe there is something to taking my thinking out of my loins, as James told us, and moving my, and like, if you think about it, right, what Kundalini is saying is that your base desires drive you. And that's sort of what the modern world is all about. It's like, how can you get status, sex, and power like that? And that's it. It's like, that's your drives and that's what you desire. And I feel those. Everybody feels those. That's the reality of being a human. But are you able to tame those and maybe allow these desires to move up to higher desires? You can move towards, as I think they say, the chakras are like your desire for pride. And that's the warrior. You start getting up to that. Then you've got this desire to be part of a group. And this is a much different feeling than, say, for example, you're like, you're just on those basic instincts and you're like, I just want to let loose the juice, that's all I want. But then at some point, if you succeed in that, you might start thinking to yourself, okay, well, the juice isn't really that fulfilling. I'd like to have a group of people who are high quality, a community and all that stuff. And then you start going even higher and you're like in the intellectual Kundalini space and you're like, I'd like to create something that motivates, that moral, that energizes, that inspires the community to fight for something great, like Roman statues, who knows, something like that. So maybe that's the approach you should take about it. That would be my thoughts on Kundalini. I'm no expert otherwise.
I had an image, and I know this is against what we were saying earlier, but I had an image as you were saying that of just like a musical, and you could create this. I really want you to create this. I think everyone see this, of a guy who's just sort of looking at his penis, and he loves his penis because it gives him joy. It is his pride and joy, but then he realizes one day that no, he must move on from his penis, and he sees this beautiful girl, and he sees beautiful mountains, and he sees Thus Spoke Zarathustra, and he's like, no more dick, and then he decides to go, no, not for life. And then there's like a whole epic ring cycle, I guess, that's built on top of that. So I hope that you go ahead and make something.
You know
that.
What, James? I'll put it down on the to-do list, and we'll see what happens.
Make semen musical. But to address your question, Hammer, I could answer this. I'm going to do a cop out. I could answer this with like theory stuff, but I think I know you fairly well by this point. And if something's gonna, if you're playing around with something and it's giving you relief, if it feels good to you and it's not taking it, shut up.
Sorry, gents. Keep going, gents.
If it feels good to you, if it's not taking away from your life, I see no reason to pull yourself away from it when there are warnings from other people or whatever to not engage in certain things.
I'm literally too immature. Like, I'm literally like a little kid. You can tell that I need to work on my Kundalini. It's like, oh, nut joke, juice joke. Sorry, sir. Keep going.
I gotta compose myself. Hammer. Nothing is a substitute, because I know you're interested in this in like an ethereal type of way, like a shaman type way. Nothing is a substitute from going out into the real world properly. So any kind of magical shamanic stuff that you might be involved in, you can play around with it. You can dabble on the side, even if it's sexually related, dabble with that. But the most important thing is you to focus on the real world. That's the answer that I'm going to give to you specifically. If you want to talk to me more about it, DMs are always open though, of course. Apart from that, I think that's enough. We spent too much time on questions today. And this is already a long enough presentation, an hour and a half, I think. So with that, we are going to close. Have you got any final words for the beautiful people, Steph?
No, not at all. That was excellent. Great job, sir. Great job. Great presentation, as usual. And by all means, again, I will say it. I said it once, I'll say it again. Check the comments. I will leave a link to Jimmy's channel. Hop over to Jimmy's channel. Give that a sub. There will be a new stream coming up from there, and we'll see what happens. This could be very, very interesting. But nonetheless, we are talking about action. And we want you to take action from this stuff. We want you to learn from this stuff. Jung was he didn't sit around thinking about his juice. He went out and he used his juice. So we must all be the same. Thank you very much, people, for your time. And I will see you later. James, any last words?
Yes, yeah. Philosophical point. If retaining your nut increases your perception of synchronicity, and Jung had the ultimate set of synchronicities, do you think he was on No Nut? Like, a serious question. Do you think he was, or was he spilling it all the time?
Or maybe he just had a more potent nut than most people. Like, maybe he had like most people get sort of like a peanut, but he had like an acorn quality. Or maybe like he could have had a coconut quality. You never know. Coconut's a good symbol for that.
Clacking around down there. So he had the highest concentration in milligram per mils of sperm.
Well, maybe
in his balls.
See, you can't get too technical, man, because it could be like maybe each individual little boyo like actually wiggled more.
So it's actually creating some kind of beautiful current in the air, that energy. It must have had very, very warm testicles, if this is the case. Very warm balls. So I had to put them in the sink to cool them off.
Dude, he's definitely haunting you now. He's definitely haunting you now. It's like, you don't stand a chance. He's going to find
That's
out.
That's why he wasn't so clear on specifically his
method. Uh-oh. You kind of froze a little bit there. I think Jung got
doing
you.
Standing in the bathroom with his nuts. I think, yeah. I think the spirits are trying to mess with us. So with that, thank you, everybody. Love you very much. Bye, goodbye.
Bye, bye, bye. Bye, bye, bye.